The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
President, there is a war going on in this country, and I'm not referring to the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan. I'm talking about a war being waged by some of the wealthiest and most powerful people in this country against the working families of the United States of America, against the disappearing and shrinking middle class of our country. The reality is that many of the nation's billionaires are on the warpath. They want more, more, more. Their greed has no end, and apparently there is very little concern for our country or for the people of this country if it gets in the way of the accumulation of more and more wealth and more power. Mr. President, in the year 2007, the top 1% of all income earners in the United States made 23.5% of all income. Top 1% earned 23.5% of all income, more than the entire bottom 50%. That's apparently not enough. The percentage of income going to the top 1% nearly tripled since the 1970s. In the mid-1970s, the top 1% earned about 8% of all income. In the 1980s, that figure jumped to 14%. In the late 1990s, that 1% earned about 19%. And today, as the middle class collapses, top 1% earns 23.5% of all income, more than the bottom 50%. Today, if you can believe it, the top one-tenth of 1% earns about 12 cents of every dollar earned in America. So we talk about a lot of things on the floor of the Senate, but somehow we forget to talk about the reality of who is winning in this economy and who is losing. And it is very clear to anyone who spends 2 minutes studying the issue that the people on top are doing extraordinarily well at the same time as the middle class is collapsing and poverty is increasing. Mr. President, if you can believe this, you know, many people out there are angry. They're wondering what's happening to their own income, to their lives, the lives of their kids. Since between 1980 and 2005, 80% of all new income created in this country went to the top 1%, 80% of all new income. And that's why people are wondering and asking, what's going on in my life? How come I'm working longer hours for lower wages? How come I'm worrying about whether my kids will have as good a standard of living as I've had? From 1980 to 2005, 80% of all income went to the top 1%. Today, the Wall Street executives, the crooks on Wall Street, whose actions resulted in the severe recession that we are in right now, the people whose actions, illegal actions, reckless actions, have resulted in millions of Americans losing their jobs, their homes, their savings. Guess what? After we bailed them out, the CEOs today are now earning more money than they did before the bailout. Mr. President, while the middle class of this country collapses and the rich become much richer, the United States now has by far the most unequal distribution of income and wealth of any major country on earth. When we were in school, we used to read the textbooks which talked about the banana republics in Latin America. We used to read the books about countries in which a handful of people owned and controlled most of the wealth of those countries. Well, guess what? That's exactly what is happening in the United States today. Mr. President, the wealthiest people in this country, not all of them, by the way, not all of them. There are many wealthy people in this country who understand and are proud to be Americans, who understand that one of the things that's important is that all of us do well. But there are, on the other hand, many others whose apparently only concern is more and more wealth and more power for themselves. And this is an issue, this greed is an issue that we have got to deal with. Now, in the midst of all of this, growing income and wealth inequality in this country, we are now faced with the issue of what we do with the Bush tax cuts of 2001 and 2003. And if you can believe it, we have people here, many of my Republican colleagues, who tell us, oh, I am so concerned about our record-breaking deficit. I am terribly concerned about a $13.7 trillion national debt, terribly concerned about the debt that we're going to be leaving to our kids and our grandchildren. But wait a minute. It's very important that we give over a 10-year period $700 billion in tax breaks to the top 2%. Oh, yeah, we're concerned about the debt, we're concerned about the deficit, but we are more concerned that millionaires, people who earn at least $1 million a year or more, get on average $100,000 a year in tax breaks. If you got a $13.7 trillion national debt growing, you've got growing income inequality, top 1%, earning more income than the bottom 50%, but the highest priority of many of my Republican colleagues is to make sure that millionaires and billionaires get more tax breaks. I think that that is absurd. But it is not only income tax rates that we're dealing with. It is the estate tax as well. And let's be clear, while some of my friends want to eliminate completely the estate tax, which has been in existence in this country since 1916. Let us be clear that every nickel of benefit, all of those benefits, will go to the top 0.3%. And if we did, as some of my friends would like, eliminate the estate tax completely, it would cost us $1 trillion in revenue over a 10-year period, all of the benefits going to the top 0.3%. So I am sure that in a little while, my friends are going to come down to the floor and say, we're very concerned about the deficit. We're very concerned about the national debt. But you know what we're more concerned about? Giving huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country. But, Mr. President, the tax issue is just one part of what some of our wealthy friends want to see happen in this country. The reality is that many of these folks want to bring the United States back to where we were in the 1920s. And they want to do their best to eliminate all traces of social legislation which working families fought tooth and nail to develop to bring a modicum of stability and security to their lives. There are people out there, not all, but there are some who want to privatize or completely eliminate Social Security. They want to privatize or cut back substantially on Medicare. Yeah, you're 75 years of age and you have no money. Good luck to you getting your health insurance at an affordable cost from a private insurance company. I am just sure there are all kinds of private insurance companies out there just delighted to take care of low-income seniors who are struggling with cancer or another disease. Mr. President, furthermore, there are corporate leaders out there and many members of Congress who not only want to continue, they want to expand our disastrous trade policies. My wife and I went.
Well, it looks like we had a parody error there on the computer, but anyway, you get the thrust of it. That was Bernie Sanders on the floor of the Senate in the middle of December, this month, I should say, talking about the real war, the war on the people of this country that is being waged by Wall Street and its allies in government. And on the phone I have Patricia, I think. Are you there, Patricia?
Yes.
All right, excellent. And Kevin Barrett on for an encore performance. Are you there, Kevin?
Hey.
Hey, sure am, Rich.
All right.
Good to be with you.
Hey, Kevin.
Yeah, hi. Great to be back.
So I thought, among other things, today we could talk about the increasing, you know, terrorist threat, you know, the impending doom that that our protectors in Washington, the people who are paid by our tax dollars to serve the public interest, our public servants, as they used to call them, now they call them officials and authorities. They're talking these days about increasing level of terrorism in the world and threats of terrorism. And how we all need to hunker down and join in the march to a police state. And so, there was an article actually on Prison Planet, which is one of Alex Jones' websites. Unfortunately, Alex Jones, you know, I don't agree with a lot of his economics. I think he's kind of clueless about economics. But he certainly is on top of the false flag terrorism issue, which the media refuses to cover. His website put out an alert a couple of days ago, talking about how the media is starting to carry all kinds of stories, talking about threats Attorney General Holder has been talking about homegrown terror threats. Holder said, according to the Associated Press, Holder said that the terrorism threat is real and constant from homegrown terrorists. You know, apparently people spontaneously putting on turbans and carrying around bombs in their body cavities or something. He says he's concerned that the authorities may have missed a signal that an attack is coming. He says Americans have to be prepared for, quote, potentially bad news. And, wow. I mean, these people have no shame. They just have no shame. Kevin, do you have any comments on some of the FBI patsies that have been set up, these clueless kids mostly, young people who, you know, they're on drugs or something, and they think that they want to, they're out to prove something, prove their manhood, and you know, they get together some M80s or something, and I don't know, it's easy to set these people up. you know, there's clueless fools everywhere that can be put on stage and paraded in front of the public as some kind of a existential threat to this country.
Well, it's not just the clueless patsies, although that's half the equation, but it's also very hardcore manipulation on the part of the people who set them up. And, you know, examples of this include not just the recent event in Oregon where they grabbed some teenager, but the first one like that here was the street people in Miami. A bunch of, they weren't even Muslims. They were kind of a weird sect of their own. And they were just street people. They didn't have any money. And so the FBI moved in and offered them $50,000 in cash if they would sign on to a plan to allegedly blow up the Sears Tower. These guys didn't have the faintest idea how to, you know, how to strike a match, much less blow up the Sears Tower. But hey, $50,000 in cash, okay, we'll take it. So they took the money, and the FBI agent then directed them to buy some boots. So they bought some boots, and the purchase of the boots became what the government called an overt act towards actually blowing up the Sears Tower. And I think they had to put these guys on trial three times. I think they got two hung juries, and then finally managed to convict them on the third try. But that's kind of the par for the course. You know, most of these cases involve FBI informants who move in on vulnerable people and convince them to say stupid things, and then suddenly it's the victim, the person who's been pushed and bullied and brainwashed. You know, these people have very powerful persuasive techniques, so it's the victim, really, who ends up being prosecuted as a supposed terrorist.
Yeah, where was the FBI when their own informant was asking them, do you want me to sabotage this bomb that was planted in the World Trade Center in 1993? You know, actually being told by his FBI handler, a high-level agent in the FBI, to go ahead and use real explosives, supply real explosives. I mean, this is unbelievable. The FBI was not paying attention. They were absolutely complicit in the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993.
That's right. You know, I actually heard some inside information on this case from a very famous person who I cannot name, or at least he would be very unhappy if I did. But this person, who's very, very well known in certain circles, told me that after this event, two of the guys who are now in prison for the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, some approached him and begged him to help them because they knew they had been set up. They apparently described how the intelligence services had used an Egyptian Christian, Arab, of course, but not a Muslim, who was pretending to be a Muslim, who had gotten in and basically set up the whole thing, and the guys that they arrested for that 93 bombing, apparently, many if not all of them, were completely innocent. And that's why the guy returned the Ryder truck to the Ryder rental agency. You know, people were scratching their heads about that, like, wait a minute, okay, and he goes back to get his deposit back or something on the truck, and that's how they arrested him. People said, well, why would he do that? Well, the reason, of course, was that he was completely innocent. He had no idea that his truck had been used for the bomb. And so anyway, this guy, I got the inside information from a well-known figure, is still afraid to talk about it. He's afraid they would destroy his career or worse if he even got involved.
This is the level of cowardice. I guess the word is cowardice of the American people that know better. The people that refuse to talk about this, especially the people in the media who are being paid to keep us informed about what's going on. I mean, their cowardice, their mental illness, their denial, I don't know what you call it, it borders on treason, it seems to me. I mean, I wonder whether these people really want to call themselves Americans, or whether they just, you know, maybe they'd be better off in India, you know, competing against Americans.
Well, there is a real affront to the American spirit of independence and, you know, all the good side of the Western heritage of critical thinking, empirical use, you know, logic and evidence, and so on. That's all really been just destroyed. I guess, you know, symbolically, I'm sure that the great symbol of the destruction of Western tradition and its embodiment in the USA will one day be seen as the controlled demolition of the Trade Center towers. Any idiot can see that these things aren't just falling down by, for random reasons. They're being blown up symmetrically and very rapidly. And yet this extremely obvious thing that anybody with eyes can see is completely denied by all of the authoritative segments of the society. And you know, we're living in a world where the emperor has no clothes, and there's just a bunch of kids out there saying that, but all the rest of the people and the authorities are just going through the motions as if nothing unusual had happened. And that, of course, the 9/11 was necessary to create the world that we're in now, this world of unending fake war. What it's really aimed at achieving, you know, I honestly am still a little bit confused about, you know, what these people are thinking when they sat down and you know, did this. It could be...
Today on Channel 13...
I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
you know, is it that there really was a certain kind of strategic threat, long-term strategic threat from terrorists in general or Al-Qaeda or other Islamist groups in particular? You know, some Islamist groups have been fairly successful at using what we would call terrorism, although if you're blowing up 200 Marines who've invaded your country, 200 Marines from a country that's complicit in genocide, that's just been decimating your country and your part of the world, if you call that terrorism, well, you know, I call it self-defense. But there had been some successful use of those kinds of tactics. And, you know, maybe the powers that be were actually afraid of Al-Qaeda and its ideas, which actually its goals are shared by most Muslims around the world, not its tactics. Most Muslims oppose violence against civilians, but the goals of expelling the U.S. and the Zionists from the Middle East, reclaiming the land of Islam for Islam, and reuniting the Islamic world into one great nation rather than all of these colonial enclaves that were carved out by the Europeans, is a goal that's shared by roughly three-quarters of the world's Muslims. So it's very possible that this was seen as a threat by various people, especially the Israelis, who are, you know, stand to lose their little settler colony there. And perhaps these people overreacted and, you know, tried to preemptively, you know, create defenses against what they thought was a real threat by, you know, blowing up the towers, making it look like the terrorists had a lot more power than they really do, in order to inoculate the whole society against this and, you know, turn the whole society into, you know, put it on war footing against this real threat. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is that it's all pure BS, you know, that there is no threat at all, and that it's basically an Orwellian ruse designed to increase the control of government and the super wealthy who increasingly own it. I think the reality is probably somewhere between those two extremes.
Yeah, there does seem to be a push for a political globalization as opposed to just an economic globalization going on. You know, the New World Order idea that has been alluded to in very many national leaders worldwide have been talking about this New World Order thing. And, you know, one of the necessary prerequisites for destroying national sovereignty in any, country is to create the conditions for a police state, to institute the legal and technical measures necessary to control the people when they see that they are losing their right to self-determination. And I think it's plausible that this whole terrorist charade is part of that. Holder explicitly was talking about homegrown terrorism, and of course the Oklahoma City bombings, which were also a government operation, as anyone can find out by googling, go to video.google.com and Google OKC bombing rare, and you'll see the video feeds from the local news stations in Oklahoma City showing high-grade military-grade explosives, duds, being removed from the ruins of the of the Oklahoma City Federal Building, in which I don't know how many children died, how many adults died. You know, this is Nazi operations going on here, and the American people are certainly in the crosshairs, as they always have been. But apparently the greater threat at one time was thought to be in the Muslim world, but now that the American people are waking up, they're becoming primary targets. So I think we should be aware of this this looming threat to our freedoms in under the facade of national defense.
Well, the American people are certainly not yet facing any significant threat at an individual level from terrorism. As I talked about in my book, Questioning the War on Terror, your chances of being killed in a terrorist attack are less than 1/30th your chances of being hit by lightning. So, based on all of history up to today, there is no terrorist threat at all. It's a gigantic farce. It's ridiculous that anybody even worries about it. On the other hand, because this false flag terror has been so successful for its perpetrators, and also perhaps because there really are people out there who have a major grudge against the U.S. empire for good reasons, it's, of course, a real concern that some kind of large-scale terror could happen. The nuclear option is the one that people are always worrying about. Gordon Duff, the editor of Veterans Today, who has a pretty deep intelligence background, claims that there are two missing nuclear weapons in the U.S. and in possession of the same Israeli Mossad people that did 9/11. Now, I don't know if that's correct, but I don't know if you've read any of his work over Veterans Today.
Yes, I have. He's very good.
Yeah, generally pretty credible. And so I wouldn't put it past the realm of possibility, but the reason that Gordon is on the warpath doing what he's doing is that he is genuinely concerned that we might see a nuclear false flag event in the U.S., at which point your chances of being hurt by terrorism would suddenly become much greater than your chances of being hit by lightning.
So let's talk about some of the other known false flag operations, like the underwear bomber.
Right, the underwear bomber. That was a good one. that was their Christmas present to the American people last year. And by they, I'm not talking about the radical Muslims, of course. I'm talking about the 9/11 perps and the false flag terrormeisters. They'd gotten us prepped for that with the that shooting incident at Fort Hood, and it appears that probably what happened at Fort Hood is that Major Hassan really was about to go berserk, and they helped him out with a couple of professional shooters. So that's where that's how they were able to get all those people shot, 30-plus people shot, I believe.
Yeah, the bullets didn't add up, did they? I mean,
there were too many. Yeah, the shooting was way too good for one guy, especially him. There was a world record for a military-based shooting, and he didn't seem to be the guy who should be setting the world record. And there were all sorts of reports of two more shooters at the time, and it's all been covered up. And even in the court case now, they had a military guy testifying in court that his superior officer had ordered him to give up pictures he took of the event, and those pictures are now gone. So it's clearly there's a cover-up. It appears to have been a false flag event, and that's probably what kind of was used to start the ball rolling. Lots of people really getting killed, creating a big media sensation. So once they've had their event where a bunch of people get killed, 9/11 was another of those events, then they can terrorize people with non-events for a while. And they've done that in the past with the shoe bomber, Richard Reed, who was unable to even get a match lit to try to light a fuse that would not have blown up his shoe in any case. After the Fort Hood incident, they bring on Christmas the underwear bomber. And once again, we have the same situation. We have a totally harmless guy with a bomb that couldn't hurt a flea. You know, it's plastic explosives, but it doesn't have a detonator. You can't set off plastic explosives without a detonator. So this guy was not carrying any kind of weapon whatsoever. It was just unusual underwear. But it was enough for a media event, and they scared the American people for the whole Christmas to New Year's week last year,
and
exactly 1 year ago.
let's not forget the well-dressed man who was never identified that ushered him past customs in Amsterdam.
Exactly. Yeah, that's how we know that one was false flag beyond any doubt. Is that he didn't even have a passport. You know, here's a guy with plastic explosive underwear, has no luggage. He's going to the U.S. No return ticket, nothing, not even a passport. And a well dressed man at the airport in Amsterdam escorts him aboard the plane. Kurt Haskell, the Detroit attorney, told us about that, and he and several other passengers witnessed this. And yet the mainstream media, for some reason, just won't go there. And so we get the Christmas bomber hoax, and since then we've had a number of other hoaxes, including the Times Square bomber. Once again, the same situation. There's no detonator. There's a bomb, and there's no detonator, so it couldn't possibly have hurt anybody. There's no threat whatsoever, and yet it's made to look like a huge threat, and they can kind of keep the temperature up to a certain point. The problem is, after a while, these non-bombs with no detonators that can't hurt anybody start to wear thin, and then they have to go and kill a few people. I think there's actually a whole academic specialty called terror management theory, I believe it's called. And I think that the people who are scripting all this stuff must be experts in this. You know, they know exactly when to turn the dial up a little bit, you know, make the pot boil a little harder, and then turn it down a little bit. And they just have this optimal amount of fear they apparently want in the American people.
Yeah, they're public relations firms, undoubtedly. Eddie Bernays called himself the father of public relations, and he was a double nephew of Sigmund Freud. And he took his uncle's findings about human psychology and applied them to the masses. And so, yeah, fear is a huge weapon that governments and corporations, you know, use against the people to get them to do what they want them to do. So as my friend who used to be a movie director in Hollywood used to say, be afraid. Be very afraid, because that was the big weapon that they used in Hollywood, you know, to sell their movies was fear.
Yeah,
well, you know, you're bringing Eddie Bernays up is very apropos, and it's kind of ironic because Sigmund Freud thought that what he was doing by revealing the fact that most of our real motivations are unconscious, we're not even aware of our own motivations. He thought that by revealing that and analyzing that and making it public and helping people understand what their buried unconscious motivations were, that he would be helping us achieve this, you know, Socratic maxim of know thyself. And he was going to liberate people by doing this. But his nephew, Eddie Bernays, saw that a much more direct way of dealing with this information, the fact that our human motivation is largely unconscious, and it has, you know, you can actually figure out what it is, and very specifically in certain ways, is to use that to manipulate people at the unconscious level. And that takes away from human freedom. That it actually pushes us in the opposite direction from know thyself, and we become a bunch of even, you know, lower grade, less conscious beings, thanks to this Freudian knowledge that's been misused by Bernays and the public relations and brainwashing industry ever since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Freud was actually a pretty sincere person who was trying to heal people, but Eddie Bernays was using it to make them more sick, because fear is what creates stress and tension in the body, and people get very ill when they're overstressed. So their tools were similar, well, based on some similar principles, but they were totally opposite in their intention.
Well, this sort of explains, you know, the behavior of the average guy in the street that's not paying attention, you know. But how do you account for the behavior of our so-called ace reporters, you know, the people who are supposed to be watching the government and telling us what's going on?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great question.
Well, you know, the Hippocrates' oath used to be, do no harm. It's no longer apparently applicable. And, you know, our favorite subject here is circumcision. So now, you know, it's more like do harm, especially in obstetrics, where they overdose the, you know, the mother on Pitocin and then justify a cesarean because the child at that point has been put into danger by the MDs themselves. And so I think that, you know, what maybe used to be the rule is no longer the rule. So journalists used to be protectors of truth, you know, justice in the American way. And I think things have changed because public relations, advertising, and journalism are in the same school in colleges. So I think that somehow they've all been smushed together.
That is interesting,
isn't
it?
Now journalism, for a large part, is more like public relations.
I've noticed that at MU, the people who are majoring in journalism are oftentimes also involved in public relations.
And acting, and drama, and theater.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, movies.
Speaking of circumcision, I actually have something appropriate to that. Patricia, you called my attention to it on the net. It's about infant male decapitation.
Yeah.
It's kind of amusing. You want to hear it?
Sure.
Okay.
All right.
Music sounds.
Deciding whether or not to decapitate your baby boy is a tough decision that all U.S. parents must face. With the lack of consensus in the medical community, what is a concerned parent supposed to do? We here at Channel 13 did our own investigation to help, and here's the report. Decapitation has a long history. Ancient Greeks decapitated men skilled at kleptoarts as a rite of passage over the river Styx. Egyptians were known to decapitate men to cure insanity. First, let's look at the pros of male decapitation. 1. A study conducted by Hebrew University and headed by Dr. Jaime Moshkevitz, doctor in Sangophilic Schadenfreudic Pediatrics and an extirpant of bovine flatulence, concluded that neonatal infant male decapitation was effective in preventing forehead cancer in almost 100% of the samples. Number 2. More than 90% of parents reported a significant reduction in crying from their baby boys after having routine neonatal decapitation performed. 3. The new smooth decapitator device offered by Olympic Medical provides soft straps which comfortably restrain baby boys about to be decapitated. Number 4. Decapitators use sterile instruments in a hospital setting, and they wear white robes.
Anyway, you get the idea.
Yeah, I love these kinds of discourses where you only have to substitute a couple of words. And you know, they become perfect parodies of themselves. You don't even have to work to write them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these terrorists, the terrorist threat. All you have to do is substitute FBI for Al Qaeda, and you're closer to the truth. You know,
pretty much. You know, one way I've done that kind of parody and raised some hackles at times. By substituting Jew for Muslim in certain Islamophobic discourses that are apparently okay to print in, you know, establishment journals. And you put Jew in there, and most of the people who were perfectly willing to have that kind of talk go on about Muslims suddenly go berserk. Once I went to a Daniel Pipes lecture. You know, Daniel Pipes is America's leading Islamophobe. Came to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I actually rented a costume, the Wicked Witch of the West costume. And I dressed up as the Wicked Witch of the West, and I went there as the campus witch. His group was called Campus Watch. You know, they're out making sure that, you know, nobody supports the Palestinians or anything on campus. And so I went there as the campus witch, and I had all these quotes from Daniel Pipes about Muslims. And I just changed it to Jews and started, you know, barking them out and handing out leaflets. And I had people who were about to attack me, you know, because they thought I was some kind of, you know, Hitler style anti-Semite. You know, they took it seriously, totally didn't get it. And even though it was very clear what I was, you know, what I was doing was all like labeled and stuff, you know, but that sir, it's another good example of how people evaluate things and sort of, with two different yardsticks sometimes. And you change it around, and suddenly they, using the same yardstick, they realize what they've been doing, or at least you hope they do.
By the way, you mentioned Hitler. It brought to mind that I made a mistake last show talking about Kissinger's conversation with Nixon. It was actually concerning Jews in the Soviet Union that Kissinger didn't give a damn about, not obviously Germans that were in Germany. I mean,
that would stand to reason.
Jews in Germany.
I don't think Kissinger gives a damn about much of anybody except for his own power, which he thinks is the greatest aphrodisiac.
Yeah. Well, he's a lieutenant of the Rockefeller family. He's a hotshot in the Council on Foreign Relations, and he actually, as I've mentioned before, he is giving orders to Obama's national security advisor to this day, apparently.
Yeah, and we're talking about how amazing that is, that these creepy people from so many decades back, all the way back into the 50s, where Kissinger was the model for Dr. Strangelove, Kubrick's great film, are still running the show today. Which makes you wonder what are they injecting these people with formaldehyde or what?
How? I hear that they are drinking human milk every day, but I haven't seen it, so I don't know myself. That's just what I heard.
I don't know.
It's good for babies.
Yeah,
I didn't want to think about the image of Kissinger drinking human milk every day. It's too much for me to process, I'm afraid.
I have to play some PSAs, and we will be right back.
Okay.
Some of the funds for this program are provided by listener support and by a donation from the Housing Authority of the City of Columbia. The Housing Authority provides housing for families who qualify. Located at 201 Switzer Street, the Housing Authority of the City of Columbia can be contacted at 573-443-2556.
Check it out, it's the Terminator. Hey, when'd you get back, huh?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Why are you being so jumpy? Put all that stuff behind you, okay?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org because we know where you're coming from. Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Exterminate all humans!
On KOPN, Columbia.
Yeah, talking about the veterans, they are bearing the brunt of this fascistic takeover. That's attempting to take over this country. I think I lost Patricia. Are you back, Patricia?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, yeah, my brother actually, he went to Vietnam years ago, and I was a kid and didn't realize, what a farce that was, how we were manipulated into that, and... Boy, these people have real consequences in people's lives, these Nazis. I call them Nazis. It's a convenient shorthand, but in many ways, I think they are very similar to the German Nazis in their outlook, their Malthusian eugenics and fascistic ideologies.
Well, you're aware that we imported thousands and thousands and thousands of Nazis after World War II.
Right.
I'm sure, so... I don't know if the audience is aware of that, but after World War II, many, many, many Nazis, scientists, doctors, apparently political scientists, and professors, and they came to the United States, and also they went to Russia. And so we've been manipulated ever since. We've been, the Fourth Reich ever since.
Yeah, it wasn't just scientists either. It was intelligence operatives. That was a big...
right.
They were trying to, get a good intelligence network going in the Soviet Union because the United States and Britain didn't really have much compared to what Nazi Germany had developed over the years. And so they were trying, they essentially appropriated the Nazi intelligence network in the Soviet Union by importing high-level Nazi intelligence operatives and putting them into high positions in the CIA and so on. So these are, of course, policy-making positions, not just scientists. They actually, over time, essentially they infiltrated, I assume. Well, it's probably the reverse, actually. I think the British and American intelligence infiltrated Germany and instituted the Third Reich. And now this is sort of a interesting version of blowback from that operation.
Right. Well, there are all sorts of alternative theories about the rise of the Nazis. And, you know, I'm not really sure how much credence to put in any of them. But any way you slice it, it's true that after the war, the U.S. did bring over a lot of these people, especially the intelligence people. And that was when the U.S. intelligence program started really going into some creepy stuff, especially the mind control stuff with there was MK Ultra, the big program to try to produce a mind-controlled assassin that was the most heavily funded CIA program during the 1950s. And the paper trail for MK Ultra leads throughout the 1950s right up until the early to mid-60s, and then it just stops, and there's no record of the program having been shut down, and there's, you know, no record of it continuing. It's just the paper trail ends. And where it ends, like right before the paper trail ends, there are records of apparently the first successful experiments. You know, that most of the records of MK Ultra are apparently documenting fairly unsuccessful mind control experiments in which people's minds were ruined in many cases, but not really controlled. But then they apparently started having some successes with hypnotism and with combinations of drugs and hypnotism. And there was apparently one experiment where they got to the point where they developed a drug that skilled hypnotists using that drug could get very significant control over, including post-hypnotic suggestion control over average people. The Nazis were, of course, notorious for really cruel, degrading, inhuman experimentation on human subjects. And the CIA did import a bunch of Nazi intelligence people and start doing those kinds of experiments themselves. There are those who say that Dr. Mengele, in particular, was a specialist in using trauma for mind control, and that the CIA got into that kind of Mengele-style traumatic mind control early on, and it's mostly been covered up.
Actually, this recent declassified documents that came out a few weeks ago, or maybe a couple of months ago, about the Operation Paperclip, it turned out that Mengele was one of the people that was brought over to this country after the war.
Wow. Well, you know, the people who are claiming that he was the root of some really nasty mind control stuff that was both really nasty, really successful, and never really made public in the disclosures to the Rockefeller Commission in 1974, when we first learned about MKUltra. You know, those people have been regarded as crazy conspiracy theorists, even by many of us in the, you know, 9/11 truth and JFK truth type field. But there seems to be more and more information out there suggesting that they may be correct, and that Mengele may have taught some people in U.S. intelligence how to gain total control over people, including starting with little children, by horribly traumatizing them and inducing multiple personalities and then getting control over the multiple personalities.
You know, this
I don't know if you've read about the Franklin cover-up.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. This sounds right. A lot like standard American obstetrics, actually. But
that's true. You know, people, these professionals who inflict trauma on other people for social, you know, socially condoned or socially ordered reasons, I think, have a lot in common, whether they're Dr. Mengele doing his mind control experiments or Dr. Williams circumcising your kid, I suppose.
Patricia, you actually have some extensive knowledge into the use of trauma as a tool of social control, do you not?
As a social control?
Well, I mean, hypnosis, trance.
Oh, hypnosis. Yeah, I'm but I really help people release trauma. I don't know much about how to induce it. I do know that, you know, fear is not too easy, too difficult it's what gets stuck and makes people malleable. It overloads their circuits so that then, you know, they can believe things that aren't necessarily true, but, you know, fear, trauma, yes, good tools for tyrants.
Yeah. So what are the best tools for getting rid of it, or for lowering the level of fear and anxiety? I know meditation, for example, is one that works for me. And of course, also there are belief systems. I'm a Muslim, and we have this sort of wonderful, call it fatalism if you want, where we believe that everything is maktub, it's been written, and so we are, you know, exactly where Allah made it necessary that we should be, and so we just totally surrender to our moment and surrender to our reality. And so that there's a sort of religious aspect to this, and then, you know, there's also meditation practices that put people into a deep relaxation, and my experience has been that really kind of, you know, takes me out of the loop of being susceptible to induced fear. What do you think are the best ways to try to step out of that loop?
You know, do you guys experience a cutting out of our voices?
No.
Or is that just on my phone? Okay. So it's just on my phone, I guess. Well, what I do to help people release fear is teach them to, you know, just focus on what it is that's causing the fear, and then to continue to breathe naturally, freely, deeply. And the word spirit means breath. And so when they allow that Holy Spirit to fill them up, when they let it in, when they, it acts as an internal massage, and it releases all the tensions that are caused when people are in fear. So I go directly to my breath when I'm in fear. It's a natural thing for me now, just to know to do that instead of continuing to hold my breath, which is what most people do when they feel fear. They just go, you know, and then if you can get them to go, you know, then it just goes away.
I think a lot of people do not realize that they're living in fear. I think it's just a constant state of stress, and they don't really know where it's coming from, but it causes them to, you know, erect walls around their psyche, and, you know, it makes it difficult to relate to, you know, it basically is, a recipe for sociopathy, which is an instrument of social control. I think a society of sociopaths is a society which is incapable of self-organization, and thus, all the sociopaths are, you know, obedient to their masters, the authority figures on TV.
Yeah. You know, I actually learned how to step outside of the fear loop a little bit when I started doing 9/11 truth activism. You know, the experience of going out into the middle of campus and putting up 9/11 was an inside job signs, handing stuff out, you know, maybe doing some bullhorning, etc. Here I was expressing something that was getting a pretty bad reaction, of course, from a certain segment of people, and you know, it's doing something that's going to induce fear in most people. You know, go out and do something controversial in public. And so I started doing a whole lot of that kind of activism, and you know, got into situations where I was doing some interviews with hostile journalists and so on. And pretty soon I started to realize how much of my previous existence had been governed by fear of what people thought of me. And I suddenly realized that, wow, you know, I've been going through my professional life on campus really, you know, being worried about, you know, what my supervisor would think, what my department chair would think, you know, what kind of evaluations I'll get from the students, you know, where I'll be in this little academic hierarchy. And all of that is basically fear-based. It's all the same kind of adrenaline reaction as any other kind of fear. And then looking around at other people, I noticed they're all in the same kind of fear trance that I used to be in. And so for me, actually, doing 9/11 truth activism was a pretty good form of therapy for getting out of that fear of what other people think, which is, of course, probably mostly what holds society to get together.
That's right. And that's why people do that circumcision thing, too, because they're afraid that if they don't, then they'll be ostracized by the society, or their child will be ostracized by society. And they use that as an excuse to do it. You know, it's like it's fear that drives our inflicting trauma on the children. And then, you know, it's like a meme. It's like, you got to do this, you got to do this, you got to do this. When, you know, actually it's completely unnecessary.
Not only is it unnecessary, it's harmful. It's terribly harmful.
It's harmful, and it's hurting people, you know. So, and then it's continuing the fear being passed down generation after generation, so that, you know, when you tell a child you live in a very dangerous, hostile world, they just go, yeah, I do. People hurt me, you know.
Yeah, a lot of this also is true. A lot of it is driven by denial, of course. I mean, the people who promote circumcising babies are circumcised oftentimes themselves, and to face up to the reality of what's happened to them and what they've lost is just too painful, you know. And they just rather help perpetuate the myth than actually consciously address the underlying issue.
Do you think there's an element of projection in the way that there are so many Western activists, and even just non-activists, just a lot of Westerners, they hear about female circumcision off somewhere in Africa, and then they make a huge issue out of that and start imagining that all Muslims do this, and therefore Muslims are a bunch of evil barbarians, and it becomes a factor in this Islamophobic hysteria that's leading to war against all these Muslim countries. You think that part of that is just projecting onto this other people far away what we're actually doing to our own kids?
Probably on an unconscious level, yeah, I think that's true. I think the whole barbaric ritual was not even religiously based initially. It was inflicted by slave masters on their slaves in Egypt, and also apparently it also took hold in Central Asia around Uzbekistan.
Really?
Yeah, where they actually have what they call flaying rituals of young, you know, adolescents. I'm not even going to go into it, but it's just too horrific to even conceive of. That's
pretty weird, because the way I studied it in Islam is that apparently it was picked up from Judaism, because there was close contact between the earliest Muslims and the Jews of the city of Medina. And some of the Prophet Muhammad's early advisors were Jewish. And I had thought that it was sort of a badge of identity that was used by Jewish people to differentiate themselves from non-Jewish people. But if it actually started in Egypt and it was done to slaves, which is, of course, what the Jewish tribes or Hebrew tribes were then, that would put a whole different kind of spin on it. You know, it reminds me of that Dr. Seuss book, The Sneetches. You know, some Sneetches have bellies with stars and some don't have any on Mars or whatever. You know, it's like it's a Dr. Seuss book where there's these birds put a big star on their bellies to prove they're different and therefore better than anybody else. And as soon as all the other ones start doing it, then they take their stars off to prove they're better than anybody else. And, you know, and I wonder, you know, that's what I always thought circumcision kind of was a sign of Jewish superiority, of God's chosen people and the covenant, you know.
Well, I think that it is definitely a badge of identity for the Jewish people, but it's like the black people have appropriated the N-word as a badge of honor, you know, a badge of belonging to a group. You know, belonging to a group, even if the price is high, oftentimes can be a very empowering and, you know, psychologically reassuring thing to do.
Well, I read something recently that was very educational, because, you know, we kind of take for granted that we understand Bible stories and that the Jews definitely were slaves in Egypt. But if you read the story of Joseph, isn't he the one who interpreted dreams and ingratiated himself?